I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and today we are re-airing a May 23rd, 2019 conversation with Richard Powers about his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Overstory.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. Richard Powers, who I've spoken to quite a few times before, has won the Pulitzer Prize in fiction. It can only be cause for celebration. I don't think that a prize confers value on a book. I think a book confers value on a prize. And in this case, Richard Powers' novel, The Overstory, not only confers honor on the people on the committee that gave the book the award, I think it confers honor and valor on the reader of the book. I found the book very, very moving. The words awe-inspiring come up several times in the pages of the book, but I thought the book was awe-inspiring, or as the younger generation says all the time, awesome.
Oh, bless you for all that. I'm so glad that radio audiences can't hear me blush. That's really lovely.
And you're not ashamed in this book to call a tree beautiful, awe-inspiring, wonderful, to let the people looking at the tree to perceive in the tree a level of familiarity with the earth and with civilization that human beings just don't have.
There was something in the creation of this book that just kind of set me loose and removed fear and removed reticence and removed decorum sometimes, I guess. But to venture into that world and to say these creatures are beyond our comprehension. They are stunning. They are beautiful. They are intelligent. They have agency. They have purpose. They have meaning. To me, that was going into a brand new place. And I think in retrospect, when I think back about that, maybe there should have been a little bit more fear. Maybe there should have been a little more trepidation about making those kinds of statements. But I got swept up into that world as I was making the book, and there was no looking back, really.
It's aware, like much ecofiction, that the world we live in is coming to an end. Yeah. Not maybe coming to an end, yeah. Is coming to an end of some sort, yeah. At some time.
That's right.
And will the end be followed by something? Well, the last section of the book supposes that there is inevitably something that follows something. Yeah. I noticed that you had been teaching at Stanford, and something tells me that this environment that you found, the trees, the forest, the redwoods, going up this coast, all the way up to Oregon, introduced you to a new vision of the world.
Yeah, it launched me into a new kind of consciousness, I guess, that not only brought me into a world that I had been pretty much oblivious to up until that point in my life, but it actually returned me to the world of my childhood with new eyes. So when I arrived in Stanford to teach and set up home in Silicon Valley, one of the strangest and most fraught and most powerful places in the country. I was 55. I was totally tree blind. I believed, you know, I was guilty of that thing that most of us are guilty of, that when we say the real world, We mean the human world, to be within easy walking distance of Apple's headquarters, Google's headquarters, Intel's headquarters, Netflix, Facebook, HP, you know, you name it. You know, the companies that made the so-called real world of today. That's an intense place to live. But to be able to escape town, to go up into the Santa Cruz Mountains and see these creatures that exist on a completely different time scale, on a completely different physical scale, with completely different kinds of agency and intention, it opened my eyes.
In the first section, which is called Roots, we meet the nine major characters. Each of
the nine
them,
major human characters.
Yes, the nine major characters who are capable of participating right. in dialogue with yes. one another,
yeah.
as opposed to intimation.
Yes, well, the trees are speaking, but in another language.
In another language.
The nine human characters that launch this story.
Yeah. And in part two, as you would expect in a more conventional kind of novel, these characters meet one another.
Right. So I go from the roots of the story into the trunk, into a central joined narrative thread.
And they meet each other, and each couple, it seems, is aligned with a particular tree.
That's right.
So it's not man, woman, and child.
That's
it's
right.
man, woman, and tree.
Yeah.
And usually one member of the human couple, most often the man, needs to be introduced to the transcendental nature of what he's seeing in the forest.
As I did, just as I did, they all have their road to Damascus moments where the scales fall off their eyes and they realize that their lives are what they are by virtue of these other creatures that have enabled them.
Yes. And one of these characters, I would think the youngest, but certainly the youngest in spirit, is a game designer.
Mm-hmm.
His parents came to America from India.
Right.
His father taught him computer programming. And so he's the first in this book to notice that he's not seeing the world.
Mm.
He's seeing a representation of the world.
That's right.
And that with the games, because he designs games and has given them away for free.
That's right.
Before he invents one called Mastery,
right.
which becomes world famous
right.
and makes him into a millionaire. This boy, millionaire.
Right,
that's
many
hardly,
times over.
Yeah.
Right.
He's met a man who's played the game Mastery
right.
and who's gotten sick of it.
Yeah.
As many people have gotten sick of playing games that they can't stop playing.
Yeah, that's right.
And this person says to the boy, what is the boy's name?
Nile.
Yes.
Nile Mehta.
He says, it's always the same game. There are different aspects, but it's always the same, and it's become tedious to me.
Yeah.
And Nile goes back to his board and says, enough of players taking over the world.
Right.
What about players who have to learn what the world is like,
right.
how the world is shaped?
Right.
What if they need to be taught by the game what the world is?
Right.
And this is the motive of this book.
Yeah.
It wants to teach its characters what the world is.
Right.
Some of them are blind.
Right.
Some of them are the opposite of blind. Some of them are prophetesses and seers.
That's right.
But they all are existing in something of a skewed relationship
right.
to the acceptance that the trees have something to say.
That's right. It's not even a thinly disguised allegory. It's simply an instance of a game that we've all been trapped in and that has, you know, has colonized us to the point where we don't even realize they're all are alternatives. And that same problem with the game, that you defeat level 5, and now there's a level 6, and you get to 12, and then there's a 13. And that
yes,
is
the, maybe there's a volcano first,
right,
or an earthquake,
right,
but you're starting over again with the same thing.
And to me, it was that realization that I had in the Central Peninsula, living in Silicon Valley, that we humans have lost our way in a game called, whatever you want to call it, human exceptionalism, capitalism, individualism, this pursuit of a private meaning that's mediated through commodities. And, you know, I just kept coming back to this famous utterance attributed to Rockefeller when asked how much is enough. He gave the answer, just a little bit more. And the turning outward from that game into the world beyond the real world, the world that the trees have been making for us for the last 400 million years, changing the atmosphere, filtering the water, building up the soil, that was a turn from a private meaning to a meaning out there. And that's, to me, that's what this book is. It's a book about, you know, how there is no separate thing called humanity and no separate thing called nature. We're either in the world or we're in some kind of abstraction that will never satisfy us.
Well, I'm talking to Richard Powers about his wonderful novel, The Overstory, which won the Pulitzer Prize. This book has sections about the interaction of human beings and nature that are so incredibly lovely, so beautifully written, so touching, that I don't know how to put it. I haven't fallen in love with a book in a new way in quite some time. This book crouched down to me and said, "Michael, the world is beautiful, and you don't always believe that. Let me convince you. Let me show you how. Let me show you why. And let me do it in a way that you don't get to leave the book unconvinced. You are going to be in the power of a book that has a forest that speaks to you. Its ability to inspire a group of humans, I mean, back when I was in college, they'd have been called the Buffalo Nine or the Buffalo
right,
Five.
Right.
Here are the Palo Alto Five.
That's right.
And they have decided that in the same way, one of them points out, that you would protect your home against invasion, let's protect the forest.
Yeah.
A woman who becomes Professor Pat.
Right.
She writes a book. It takes her years. It becomes a bestseller. Right. It never stops being read. What is it called? The Lost Forest.
Yeah.
This teacher has written a book about trees and forests in which the trees and forests speak.
Right. What exalts her, what gives her the ability to do this thing, to have this vision and to put it into a volume, actually has to do with the transformation in our world, in our understanding and what's happening in a forest that's been unfolding now for several decades, but has been absolutely surprising and eye-opening to not just to the general public, but to the people actually doing the work. That is, that trees are communicating to each other over the air. They're sharing an immune system. They're sending each other preemptive signals that are changing their behaviors. They are linked together underground by fungal connections, trading resources, feeding each other, giving medicine to one another. It's an astonishing transformation in our understanding in how an ecosystem works.
Well, like the Wicked Witch of the West sending out the winged monkeys, the trees can call wasps to protect them when they're being attacked.
That's right.
They have recruits
That's right.
who will come to their defense, rescue is the theme of this book. And human beings are unfortunately not understanding
that
there are things that we might call, that the professor calls, the giving trees.
Right. That system of the real world that we humans have created, the world of a capitalist moderated individualism, was based on a misunderstanding, or justified, let's say, by a misunderstanding of what's happening in the world beyond the human world. We had this gross misinterpretation of Darwinian evolution, this belief that somehow the only powerful, relentless agent shaping the future of life was competition. And what Patricia is saying in her work, in articulating these recent discoveries, is that for every act of competition, there are many acts of cooperation. And it's this recovery of this idea that life succeeds all together as a reciprocal, interdependent system of voices and agents that are tied, whose fates are tied together, that is at the basis of her vision. It's at the basis of this narrative. If we somehow could grasp that conversation, that community, that interdependent society, if we could somehow come to see that these trees that we thought were simply there trying to outdo one another are actually in a community, feeding, ministering, caring for one another, without having that sound like an embarrassing anthropomorphism, if we could grasp that, then we could start thinking differently about what our possibilities here might be.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Richard Powers about his book, The Overstory. We continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Richard Powers about his book, The Overstory, an ambitious epic that remakes the landscape of environmental fiction. Now, we begin in a place that we feel we very well know. I've heard all my life about Dutch elm disease. Mm. It hadn't really occurred to me that it came over with the Dutch, and nor did I particularly understand ever that Dutch elm blight meant that for the longest time we'd lost these trees. Yeah. Yes,
and the book begins with a similar story to the Dutch elm incursion. This one was actually much more catastrophic for the country. It was the chestnut blight came over on imported plant material from Asia and was first detected in New York at the very beginning of the 20th century. And by 1940, this magnificent tree, the tree that some have called America's perfect tree, a tree that made up one quarter of the eastern woodlands, running from New England down into Georgia, was gone, was destroyed. And that story, so much a story of, you know, the transformation of a way of life, of a world, isn't hugely known to Americans. And my sense was that this is where this novel had to begin. I am an Easterner. I was born in Chicago and grew up there before moving abroad, and I came back to Illinois to finish school. I then moved to Boston and worked for many years there. I am an Easterner by orientation and by familiarity. it took this trip to the West Coast. It took this moment of aha in front of the Redwoods to realize that I had taken my own landscape for granted. To see those magnificent trees, you know, the enormity of them, the time scale of them, turned me to an attention for trees much smaller, much less spectacular. But when I got back to the East and began to look at my own trees again for the first time, I realized I'd lived a half a century without a clue as to what they were like or what they were doing or the complexity and the magnificence of their behavior. So at that point, I began to read everything that I could about trees. I wasn't, you know, Michael, people say, well, you must have done a tremendous amount of research for this book. I wasn't doing research for the book. I was just trying to see my world.
Well, in the course of this book, a couple are helped, and they need the help, to climb a redwood tree.
Right.
And up above, that's why it's the overstory. Mm. When you're up above,
right,
you're seeing us down below,
yeah,
as the understory.
That's right.
And they, among those branches, find berries growing,
yeah,
little pools with fish
and
swimming.
Salamanders.
And, yes.
And 6-foot hemlocks growing out of the branch of a redwood tree, that there's an entire world up there.
A whole,
yeah,
world. And they're sleeping up there. And they become so stabilized,
yeah,
up there,
yeah,
that they stay for a year,
yeah,
living.
Yeah.
What is it?
200 feet in the air. And, you know, here's the astonishing thing about that passage. You know, these people putting their bodies on the line to prevent this last 2% of old growth redwood from, you know, being cut down. And they put their lives on the line. They put their bodies on the line. What's interesting about the ecosystems up there in the canopy of the redwood forests is consensual wisdom prior to this time was that there was nothing up there, that it was a monocrop desert up there. And a few people, Steve Sillert, the researcher among them, said, we're going up and having a look. And they were finding not just a rich, profuse ecosystem, they were finding endemic species, species that don't live anywhere else.
While it's obviously true that this book is an allegory and believes in certain things, I read it with pleasure, mm, without feeling that I had to believe anything. I felt, mm, oh, what a good time I'm having. How beautiful this description is. I mean, I'm a fan of the Oz books,
right,
and being introduced to the marvelous land of the ecosystem didn't require,
hmm,
that I become a different kind of reader. It just required, as always, that I appreciate good writing.
That's lovely. You know, it was a challenge for me because when I first began to realize that literary fiction, as I had inherited it, did not yet have a place for the non-human in the way that I needed. I didn't know how to solve that problem. I mean, we have become so incredibly gifted and skilled and sophisticated in our ability to tell stories about individual people, about domestic relationships, about the relationship inside a family, about people in a community, and to create these rich textures of moral ambiguity. But we had somehow forgotten how to tell stories about the relationship between the human and the non-human. I want to tell a story about the interdependence of humans and trees. And at the end of the day, even though I thought for a while that I was adding to something to literary fiction that I hadn't seen, I realized that I was actually just going back. I was going back a few centuries to older kinds of storytelling, where it would never, no one would ever dare to tell a story about who we are without also bringing onto stage the neighbors, all the other non-humans with whom we need to share this world. It is a book that invokes hundreds of myths about trees from all kinds of different cultures, that brings the trees on as a supernatural, in the etymological sense of that, creatures, agents, moral agents. But it's also a world that I think the reader of a modern novel can enter into, because there's enough of the mechanism and the structure of a traditional novel to make that personal story the starting point for this other mythological excursion.
We're introduced to storytelling taking place in different time frames, right, in different legend, mm-hmm, frames. Think about the difference between the tree in the Garden of Eden on the one hand and the tree at the center of the world. Is it Yggdrasil?
Yeah. Yggdrasil, yeah. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned that chestnut with which the book opens, and this generations of Iowa farming family who plant this tree way out of the native range of the chestnut. And this man who has this bizarre idea of taking a picture of it once a month from the same vantage point, and his son takes over the project from him, and his son takes over the project from him. At the end of a century, you have...
It becomes a flip book.
A flip book.
And you can watch the tree growing in a minute.
Yeah.
That took place over a century, because they took the pictures once a year.
Yeah, and you have this, the slowest, shortest silent film that, you know, the century of tree growth that you flip by in your fingers in a few seconds also reveals that this family, the generations, have been passing in and out of the foreground of this tree like time-lapse sped-up figures. And it's this collision of tree time with human time that gives each of those frames a kind of intensity that they don't have outside of.
Yes, the environment to the tree. They're the scenery instead of vice versa.
And that's right.
I've been talking with Richard Powers, author of The Overstory, published by W.W. Norton and Company. I think this is a wonderful book. If you've read Richard Powers before and you haven't read him in a while, this is the place to start again. It's a magnificent book. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's been such a pleasure.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple and Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, you can listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to John Sullivan and Alan Howard. The technical director today is Phil Richards. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.